The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
It's time for our Friday panel, and I'm delighted to welcome Ian Power, CEO of Spunout.ie and PR Director with Unique Media, Breda Brown, to the show. Good evening to you both.
How are you? Frank.
I'm really well, thanks. We've loads to talk about today, but there is really only one place to start. Owen Harris, a well-known columnist with the Sunday Independent, has confirmed that the newspaper has fired him. Ian, might start with you. Can you tell us what do we know about the decision to terminate his contract?
Yeah, so the newspaper announced this yesterday, and they said that Mr. Harris was responsible or behind the Twitter account with the name Barbara J. Pym, which the editor of the Sunday Independent, Alan English, said went far beyond fair and reasonable comment. And I think what's remarkable about the account is a number of things, really. Number one, Mr. Harris says he's one of a number of people behind the account, which is quite an interesting concept. I don't know about many personal Twitter accounts that have a number of people behind them. And then secondly, it is remarkable that the account was blowing smoke about Owen Harris's own column, saying that, you know, they were great and he had wonderful views and should be celebrated. The other thing is that the Irish Times is reporting this afternoon that Twitter has suspended a further 8 Twitter accounts that are suspected to be related to the Barbara J. Pym account as well, which makes the whole situation even more peculiar. But as well, I think there's an insidious aspect to this as well, in that the political correspondent for the Irish Examiner, Aoife Moore, tweeted last night that the account had sent her abusive, insulting messages, particularly when she had just started her job. So it's quite an interesting and peculiar story, and definitely one of those goo-boo moments, I think, for sure.
Breda, he has confirmed to the newspaper that he was involved in running this fake Twitter account, but as Ian mentioned a moment ago, he has suggested that he was just one of a number of people who had access to that account. So let's not attribute any individual tweets to him. But can you give us a flavour of the type of posts that appeared on the account's feed?
Well, again, that's the worrying part, is that there are others involved, you know, because, again, first thing you need to think about, what on earth were they thinking about? Because if you're going to set up a fake account, there's a couple of reasons why people might do that. The first one may be just to lurk, to see what other people are doing. But once you do it and start engaging for other purposes, that's a whole different scenario. They were generally posting about Irish politics in general. But as Alan English said yesterday in his statement, a lot of them went beyond reasonable comment. Now, you know, Owen Harris is known as quite a contrarian, I suppose, anyway, and a huge critic of Sinn Féin as well. And a lot of posts would have sort of related to that type of politics. But where it does get concerning, again, as Ian mentioned, is that some of those posts were actually, you know, as Aoife Moore said, she was getting abusive connections from those and insulting messages. She actually had to go to the guards about it. So, again, you're going back to the whole, OK, well, why set up the fake account in the first place? Secondly, who are the other people involved? And thirdly, what was their modus operandi here? So I really think there's more to come out on this, and it's definitely going to be one to watch.
Yeah, and again, just for the record, you know, we're not saying that we know Owen Harris was sending these tweets to Aoife Moore, the political correspondent for the Irish Examiner, but that is a flavour of the type of content that was appearing on that Twitter account. And Ian, doesn't it again, I was thinking about this earlier, like, it again highlights, you know, Twitter's biggest criticism, that these types of anonymous accounts can be set up like this.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you have to think about how anonymous accounts can be used, you know. So for a lot of young people we would work with who maybe are, you know, LGBTI plus and coming to terms with their sexuality, they find community in other users online and they're able to talk to each other and connect. So there's positives about, kind of anonymity and pseudonyms, but obviously not when you're getting into the realm of using them for bad purposes and bad actors using them. So I think it's, again, one of those situations where we can't have nice things because of the people in society who choose to use them for for, you know, different purposes. I guess in this instance as well, it's the fact that the accounts have been used by, you know, people whom we don't know, and we didn't know for a while who was behind, you know, the accounts. And I think that's probably the most insidious aspect of it. Whatever about if you're using it to connect with other people, or as Breedy said, to kind of just follow what's going on. There's so many people on Twitter who don't tweet and who just literally, you know, consume news and all of the things that, you know, Twitter is great for, memes and otherwise. But it kind of gets into another realm when you're kind of using it to big yourself up, or to kind of, you know, talk at length about a particular agenda, you know, where, you know, really, you would expect people who are former senators and well-known columnists to be able to put their own name to their words, you know?
Absolutely. In fairness to Twitter, Breed, it is trying, well, it says that it's trying to tackle the scourge of trolls and keyboard warriors by appeasing to the good in them. Tell us about the social media platform's attempt to reduce abusive language on Twitter.
Yeah, what they're doing now is rolling out a new prompt to users. So if you're, you know, if their algorithms find that you're about to send a tweet that could be what they deem harmful or offensive, you're going to be presented now with a new prompt, which is going to encourage you maybe to edit it, to delete it, or do you want to send it anyway? So it's one of those things that it's sort of a think before you post aspect. And what they're trying to do is basically cut down on as we mentioned earlier on, maybe abusive or insulting texts that could be, or tweets that could be sent. And interestingly, now Twitter have said that their survey results show that actually, if prompted, 34% of people actually did revise their initial reply or decided not to send it in the first place. So it seems to potentially have a place. But that was on a trial basis. So it'll be interesting to see once they put this in place totally whether it does work or not. But one of the interesting pieces as well that Twitter said that the algorithms were struggling with was essentially trying to capture nuance as well in a lot of conversations. Because sometimes, and the Irish are great at this, you know, you may have particular words or language that you use that could be just friendly banter or sarcasm, or sometimes offensive words that may be used in a different context and would not necessarily be meant to be totally
it's
offensive.
Like, it's like a language all on its own, isn't it?
Exactly, that's it. And the algorithms can't pick up on that. So they're trying to figure that out. So again, some words that could be very acceptable here in general conversation, Twitter may be asking you to be careful with or edit or delete.
But Ian, is this just a box ticking exercise? I can see so many pitfalls, and Breed has touched on a couple of them there when it comes to nuances in language and, you know, friendly banter between two friends and things like that. Do you know, this isn't, you know, moderation or censorship. It sounds more like a sleepy gatekeeper.
Yeah, I mean, I guess full disclosure, Spunout.ie, we're members of the Twitter Trust and Safety Council, so we were aware of this experiment. And I guess for us, what we're always trying to do is to get the platforms to do more of this type of thing, because the more kind of nudge features and tools that you can deploy in a platform, the more you can kind of interfere and disrupt behavior. And as you can see, I mean, we only have Twitter's word for it in terms of the experiment that they've run in terms of the results. But, you know, 34% of people revising, 11% choosing not to send the message at all. That's not insignificant when you take the numbers that you're talking about. And I guess one of the things about this experiment as well is that, you know, the cost of doing something wrong in this scenario was pretty low. The stakes were pretty low, because I guess the penalty really for guessing wrong or getting it wrong, as Breedy was talking about in terms of the nuance, is just that you get a simple pop-up, you know, right? So it's not, you know, removing content and it's not banning accounts or anything like that. It was simply a pop-up. So I think I would be encouraging platforms to do more of this. And there's a number of different things that they've had, you know, for instance, you know, if you choose to retweet an article that you've not read, it prompts you now to read that article before you do that, in an effort to kind of curb the spread of misinformation and things like that. So I'd actually be saying this is a good thing, and it's good to learn. And particularly, I think what's most important for platforms is to learn, you know, from these experiments, even if they don't work fully, you know, and to see how you can make it better going forward. Because even just harking back to our previous conversation, you know, there's a number of different things that the platforms have learned about how to, you know, identify sock puppet accounts and remove them en masse from platforms and things like that. And that only happens through experimentation. So I think, you know, more of this, please, I think is what we would be saying.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. And I was going to say as well, you know, the whole think before you post aspect, because remember when Twitter was great for the good things like news and breaking news and keeping you up to speed on what was going on. More and more now, sometimes when we go on, you know, we find that we're in the middle of pylons or we're looking at, you know, people who are, you know, harassing others. So I think, again, if this does encourage somebody to think twice about what they post, that will be no harm.
Now, this is an item that we touched on earlier in the week with the Garda Representative Association, but I think it's one worth returning to with our Friday panel, Ian Power and Breda Brown. A hotline is being set up to give people a direct line to report suspected COVID breaches in Donegal, but one local TD doesn't think it's a good idea, Breda. Why not?
So independent Donegal TD Thomas Pringle, he's basically asked the Taoiseach what planet the government is on if its response to the COVID outbreaks is setting up a Garda hotline. So the reason this has sort of come to the fore is because Stephen Donnelly, the health minister, and other public health officials last weekend had to discuss with local stakeholders in Donegal about what is happening in the county and what additional supports they need. Because apparently the incidence rate of COVID in Donegal is nearly three times what it is the rest of the country. So there's an issue there. However, you know, Thomas Pringle is saying that the response by basically setting up a hotline, the Gardaí have set up a dedicated phone line so people can ring in if they want to report any breaches. And Deputy Pringle is saying that it's a tout line, it's a rat line, and that we're basically asking neighbours to tout on, or people there living there to tout on their neighbours. And what they really need is more walk-in test centres and vaccination clinics. So I'm a bit, I suppose, I'm unsure with this one. I really have no issue with people alerting the authorities about COVID breaches because, to be honest, you know, if people are breaking the law, they are endangering others. And it's totally unfair on the rest of a local community who maybe are adhering to the guidelines and are following the scientific advice. So, you know, one or two mavericks who feel they can get away with it, I've absolutely no issue with alerting the authorities. However, did we need to set up a dedicated phone line only for Donegal? I think that sort of sends out maybe the wrong message. I think the better communications message could have been a general hotline for the whole country could have been potentially set up as opposed to just pointing the finger at Donegal. Because at the end of the day, and I'm sure this is potentially what the GRA were saying, is, you know, is there not a better use of Garda time as opposed to somebody sitting there manning a phone line just for one county on its own? And I suppose also on that as well, we saw what happened in Longford during the week where a bridal party went ahead with a reception in a marquee in Longford. And as a result of that, the bride, the groom and the parents and a couple of others have been called to come before a judge now on Monday in Longford to explain why they did this, because the judge has already said this is absolutely outrageous and an insult to the people of Longford. So, and it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of that is going to be. I mean, will they be charged? Will they not? So I think if people feel or realise that there are consequences to their actions, it might make them think twice.
Okay, let's move on then, Ian, because I want to talk to you about some great news that we had during the week for our Olympians and Paralympians as they continue their preparations for this summer's games in Tokyo. They'll be able to focus exclusively on their training. Why? Because they will be getting their COVID jab before they go.
Yeah, so this is news that basically Pfizer and the International Olympic Committee have decided to provide vaccines and to vaccinate athletes in countries that are not already being vaccinated. So obviously, if you think about places maybe like the US and the UK, maybe those teams are already vaccinated because of the pace of their vaccination program. But in obviously Ireland, as the games edge closer and closer, essentially, I think the IOC are concerned that, you know, teams that are traveling to the games, they want them to be vaccinated, both so that their preparations for the games are uninterrupted and also, I guess, making sure that athletes that are going to mingle with, you know, ones from other countries, that everyone is on the same playing field and everyone is vaccinated. So it's really quite a positive announcement. The company Pfizer is partnering at a global level, and it's said that the stocks being used do not affect any country's allocation, so it's not coming out of Ireland's vaccination pool, and it's basically said that they really just want to try to, at this point in time, you know, make sure that the athletes can get to the games. In a joint statement, they said that a positive diagnosis this close to the game still has the potential to exclude an athlete from the competition, so they really do want to kind of get all the teams protected before then.
Yeah, it's really positive. And of course, as you mentioned there, it has a dual purpose, obviously public health being first and foremost, but also it creates a level playing field, doesn't it? But Breda, let's talk about, this is again a story that we spoke about a little earlier in the week with Marion and Cal in our US slot. Bill and Melinda Gates deciding to end their marriage after 27 years together. We spoke about it earlier in the week, but we didn't have an awful lot of detail. But inevitably, more detail has emerged since then. And it appears that they had a marriage contract in place, which included what can only be described as a have your cake and eat it too clause for Bill in particular.
This is eye-opening. I can see now lots of people who are getting ready to get married over the next while maybe going, maybe we need this clause. Yeah, so it turns out, I mean, they're married 27 years, but just before they got married, they actually did an unusual deal with each other that allowed Bill to actually go on holidays annually, every year, with his ex. Now, this wasn't somebody he had a quick fling with or whatever. It was somebody that he went out with actually for 3 years. And apparently every year the two of them go away. Now, there's some miscommunication as to whether that was for a weekend or for a week, but they would go away together, generally, normally just to apparently just spend some time together and chat. And Melinda was happy with this and was happy to allow that to go ahead every year. So again, I'm not sure how many of the rest of us might agree to it. Maybe the life of the rich and famous is totally different. But certainly if my other half wanted to go for dinner with somebody, I wouldn't have an issue. But I think everybody might have a bit of a problem now with a long term holiday.
Ian, what are your thoughts on this? His ex is a lady called Anna Wimblad. And not only did they meet annually, she also played a huge role in Bill's decision to actually get married to Melinda.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is quite an interesting story because they met in 1984. They were together for 3 years. They met kind of because they were both into technology, and they actually founded kind of a joint venture together in 1999. So, you know, they had stayed kind of, you know, in touch that whole time. And I think this is a question of whether or not can you actually be friends with an ex, you know, and, you know, can
it's the whole Harry met Sally argument, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
We all know what happened there.
yeah. And so I think it seems like it's a really quite mature thing from Melinda's perspective. You know, I think if you're in a relationship and you're secure in that relationship, well, then you're not going to be worried about anybody else. And I think, you know, Gates spoke about this in an interview back in 1997. And it was quite interesting from what he said, because he was talking about their interest in biotechnology and playing putt-putt and like going out for walks in the sand dunes and just chatting away. It seemed quite wholesome. So, you know, I think, look, as long as everybody involved is happy out, who are the rest of us to judge, you know?
Yeah. And Melinda should actually have a lot to thank Anna for, certainly getting Bill up the aisle, because he'd actually sought her advice when he was thinking about getting married.
He did.
And it sounds like he really poured over that decision, because I don't know if you saw the documentary, but Melinda walked into the bedroom at one point and saw him writing out on a whiteboard the pros and cons of marrying her. So,
I know, so, and she was howling, laughing in that documentary,
incredible,
remembering it. But you're sort of going, jeepers, if you have to write out the pros and cons, you'd sort of wonder what's going on in his mind. And also, I was also wondering, it didn't specify anywhere if Melinda actually got the same agreement with Bill. So was she allowed to go off for a week's holiday with one of her exes, I wonder? I don't know.
Very, very good point. Let's move on, because we are running out of time. But I want to ask you about South Carolina, Ian. It's one of 24 states in the US that still carries the death penalty. It's one of only 9 that still uses the electric chair. They also use lethal injection, and it seems they're one step closer now to introducing a new method of executing prisoners.
Yeah, I mean, as if one way wasn't bad enough, it's nearly 10 years to the day since South Carolina last executed somebody on death row. And this week on Wednesday, they voted to bring back the firing squad as a method of state execution, because apparently there's a shortage of lethal injections in the state. And so basically this new bill would require death row inmates to choose between being shot by a firing squad or electrocuted amid a lack of lethal injections.
And they actually get to choose. They're offered the option of how they die.
Yeah, and so at the moment they've got two options: the electric chair, and as I said, drugs. But obviously those drugs are in short supply, and so this is the third option. And they've become only the fourth state in the US to do this. And actually, only three people have been executed by firing squad since America brought back the death penalty, kind of 50 years ago. And all three of those took place in the state of Utah. So okay. I mean, look, it's quite inhumane when you think about it, but. You know, the states incarcerate so many people. You know, it's just not necessarily surprising, but it's still shocking nonetheless.
We've only literally got a couple of seconds left, Breida, but some pushback over in South Carolina in relation to this, with some people suggesting that lawmakers should be made to watch these executions before they make their minds up. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree, because actually this was brought in with a significant majority. It wasn't a minority at all. The lawmakers voted 66 to 43. And that was after the Senate approved the bill by a vote of 32 to 11. So again, you know, a lot of opponents are saying, yes, let them watch it. And maybe if they were in the death row inmates' shoes, would they want to be in that situation?
OK, Breida Brown from Unique Media and Ian Power, CEO of Spunout.ie. Thank you both.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.